Good morning. Hi, everybody. Can I have a good morning maybe back?
Good morning.
Oh, thank you. Hi, I'm Ed. We're going to spend about an hour together. Apparently, I'm a case study now, which is always fun. We'll come on to why I'm a case study in a second. But one of the things that was quite interesting when I got contacted about doing this session was, all right, well, we want you to come and talk about millennials. I was like, okay, I can come and talk about millennials. We also wanted to just look at like some of the challenges that there are around coaching and mentoring for millennials and all the problems that people are having with millennials. And I was like, okay, fine. Well, I'll come and do a workshop. I can't promise I'm going to solve anyone's problems with millennials, but hopefully, what I can do is share a couple of experiences and some things that I found particularly useful working with people of a millennial age group. So hopefully, you'll take something interesting away from today. Maybe also get a chance to meet some new people and talk about some of the ideas. There's no right or wrong. I'm just giving you a couple of things to go away and knit stuff together. It's really nice hearing the first two presentations because I was like, oh, this is great. This fits exactly with what we're talking about. One of the things that I'm really big on is, wouldn't it be nice if we lived in a better working world where we were just thriving? You know, there's no obsession with growth and there's no obsession with kind of performance for just profit's sake, that actually we're living in a place where we go to work and we are fulfilled and we have a nice time. And that's what I spend pretty much all my time doing, going into organisations, doing training, workshops, coaching, facilitating discussions about how we can make the workplace a more thriving and fulfilling place to be. So the first thing I'm going to do, actually, before we just get started, is the temperature okay in here for everyone? Cool, because it was really cold not long ago, hence why I've got my scarf on. What I'd like everyone to do is just very briefly, just to get our heads into some learning space, can we just stand up for a second? Okay, cool. First of all, what I'd like you to do is we're going to just start by rubbing our temples. And don't worry if you've got makeup on, like it won't smudge, don't worry. So let's do some rubbing of the temples, maybe some gentle tapping. Lovely. And then maybe down the back of our necks. Great. And then across our shoulders. And then start tapping down our left arm. And then down our right arm. And then maybe over the back of our shoulder again, all the way down our backs. And if you can, without straining, down the back of your legs. Cool. Okay. And what I'd now like you to do is just turn to your neighbour and give them a very cheerful good morning. And if you don't know each other before, then hopefully you'll get to know each other's names. That would be quite nice. Okay, cool. So take a seat and hopefully we're feeling a little bit more, you know, a bit more active. I know what these sessions can be like if we're sat down too long. Okay, so let's get the elephant in the room out of the way. What is a millennial? So really, really interesting doing the research for this because despite being asked to come and do a session on millennials, it was quite interesting to try and work out how I would pitch this. Something really interesting for me, there's lots of different examples of dates. 1981, so people born between 1981 and 1996. You'll notice that all of my slides are paper. And despite being a so-called millennial, I actually have a preference for paper, but this wasn't going to be big enough on that sheet, so we had to blow it up onto screen. People might have also heard of Generation Y. They're the same thing. So Generation Y and millennials, the same interchangeable label, sometimes called echo boomers, because they tend to be the children of baby boomers. So if we think about the world that millennials and Generation Y grow up in, they're growing up in a world that was created for them by baby boomers. And obviously baby boomers, as we know, live through some of the most rapid growth in living standards of all human history. One of the things that's really interesting, there's loads of research around this, and some of the stuff I was reading around two researchers called Strauss and Howe, did a load of stuff around the fact that this generation were going to be perfect. They're going to be perfect civilly minded people because they've been brought up by this generation who've just had everything, and they're going to be well loved and catered for, and they'll be definitely civic minded. But then they went on and did a whole bunch of studies about traits that this age group tend to have, and there's a real mix of stuff on there. So there's some cool stuff on there, like they tend to feel quite special, they tend to be quite confident and team orientated. So they much prefer working in teams than on their own individual success. And also this whole thing about achieving is really, really important. So you need a sense of achievement. You can't just ask someone to do it because it's just a thing that you would do. Like, people want to know why. Okay. Now, some stuff on there that's maybe slightly more worrying. Sheltered. Lots of people kind of get looked after very well by their parents and their communities, so they're often quite sheltered from the things that are outside their experience. They didn't have to live through some of the stuff that baby boomers did. Quite conventional. This one always really surprises me. I'm often surprised by a number how conventional a lot of my friends are, my peers are, and also quite pressured. And for me, these two are really interesting, and they play out in a really weird way in the workplace, from my experience, is that people don't want to ask for help, and they're really scared to help other people as well, which is really interesting. So this idea of actually pressure and wanting to succeed. Also, maybe think about what schooling was like for this generation of people. And I've got lots of friends who are teachers who have been for sort of a couple of years all the way through to 40 years of teaching experience. And one thing that they've really commented on is that we've got a system now that across the Western world that only rewards a success and passing. And that kind of creates a really interesting mindset. Now, it's not all doom and gloom. I just wanted to kind of share this with you because I thought it was quite interesting as having a bit of a mix of stuff. So thinking about people that you work with, any nods in the room, seeing any some of those traits coming out? Okay, a few nods, that's cool. So, priorities at work. This for me was really interesting. So if we think about baby boomers, 1946 to 1965, typically very loyal to the organisations that they work for. They've got a very strong work ethic. You know, the idea that we should work hard gets said a lot by this group of people. And also that there's a kind of steady career path. So, you know, you might go into a job and then slowly progress up through the ranks. You might make a sideways move, but probably stay within the same profession the whole time. Generation X. So these people were born of the people who were in the interwar period, the forgotten generation. So they obviously saw their parents having grown up during, in the UK, it would be during rationing, you know, so they would have gone through that period because it would have preceded baby boomers just. Their interest here is a kind of pushback against all that. And their interest here is work-life balance, personal advancement. So they want to kind of see themselves develop. It's not just about being a cog in a machine anymore. Particularly as the world of work started to change and we weren't all in factories all the time or digging things up from the ground. Job satisfaction became really important. Again, not just about going to work and getting paid. People wanted to feel more valued, apparently. I can't speak from that experience. It's not mine. But the thing about stability was really strong here as well. What I love about this is there's sometimes this kind of pushback, like everyone rebels against their parents' generation at some point. So when you get to Generation Y, so 1981 to 1996, you've got some stuff here about what's really important is meaningful work. Like now it's even more important that I understand why. Please don't just tell me to submit a form. Like, I need to understand the bigger purpose of that form. Personal responsibility comes out strongly here, so it's linked back to success and achieving. Dynamic career paths. I've already changed career, in inverted commas, twice, and I'm only 31, believe it or not. This idea of free-flowing information. Remember, this group of people entered the workplace when computers by this point were commonplace, which is really, really interesting. So they only, like my experience, I never wrote a letter for work. I've never written a handwritten note to anybody at work. I've only ever sent emails, chatted on the phone, you know, been on like live chat with people. That's kind of the experience. So it makes no sense to me and a lot of my peers as to why you would ever hold information back from other people. Surely that's just a pain in the bum, you know, having to manage information all the time. Also, typically, when I ask my friends what makes a good manager or supervisor, they talk about the connection they have with their manager or supervisor. It's not really about, you know, whether they are performance managing them or anything like that. It's all about, do I like this person? Do they like me, and do they care about me? How do they treat me? You know, that was one of the things that I pulled out from the last session that was really interesting. How do they treat me? Does anybody recognize any of these things from some of the people that they work with? Does anyone recognize themselves in any of the other categories? I mean, with all of these things, I just think, you know, when you sit down to do research, you obviously have to boil very complex situations down to something quite simple. And I never think that, this is kind of the way it is. It's just obviously a viewpoint of some researchers. But I do think it's quite interesting just in framing this whole conversation. Okay, so one of the things I wanted to do then is just on your tables, just give you a few minutes to have a conversation about what barriers, challenges, something like that, that you face with working with millennials. Maybe that's the expectation you came to this session with. I'm also really interested in the idea that if you're doing coaching and mentoring, maybe you've been kind of hitting some blockers around doing coaching and mentoring with this age group. So any of the barriers, any of the challenges in work or coaching and mentoring, I'm just going to give you 2 or 3 minutes to have some conversations on your table about that. Cool. Off you go. Twenty more seconds. Okay, I'd like to ask you to pause your conversations, and I'm just going to try and gather a couple of ideas that have been discussed on the tables. I've been treated incredibly well today and being very well cared for, so it's a real pleasure to be here. So hopefully we're all amongst friends and we can all just be very open about this. So what kind of stuff was coming up on different tables? I'll do some sprinting around the room.
Mine's not work-related because I don't work anymore. But I'm a baby boomer and I've got a son and a daughter who are both millennials. And my son is classic millennial stuff. And so we have these bizarre conversations. I've been used to work strong work ethic, working in the same place for a long period of time, local government, public sector. My son is 27. I think he's had at least 4 jobs in the time that he's been working. So we constantly have this kind of, well, I probably don't even, attempt to coach him on the conversation around, you've got to stay at this place for at least a year, kind of imperative. You'll never get another job if you keep jumping from place to place. So there is that. He's a graphic designer, and this bit about free flow of information. My husband used to be a graphic designer, so they constantly have arguments about planning your work, writing it down. He goes straight to the computer and does his designs on that, and, you know, he doesn't see the need for kind of getting your ideas, just mapping them out first in a paper format. So
there's some stuff there about how people kind of plan and use information before they then go in, quite task orientated, just kind of getting on with it. There's also something in there, isn't there, about like the different perspectives, and when you're coaching, that there's maybe some quite different values. And while we're not going to obviously assume that everyone born in a 15 to 20 year time period has the same set of values, there is something interesting there, isn't there, about the experience that they will have had growing up, which will be very different, and how that might affect those conversations. So I'm just going to summarise as different experiences. Cool. Anything else? Any other things? Oh, I'm going to run over here now. Cool.
Hello. On my table, I was talking about there's a sense of impatience about there's a hunger to progress at work, particularly, but there's an impatience because obviously everything's available at the touch of a button. You know, I can order something in the morning; it'll be there when I get home. And that the kind of value of working towards something, maybe having to wait, and maybe dealing with a couple of setbacks on the way, that seems to be a bit of a foreign kind of concept to some of the guys that I come into contact with. That's what I'd say.
No, absolutely, and I would agree with that. Learning patience, it's really hard, isn't it? Because all this technology that's kind of come about over the last sort of 20, 25 years has made it easier and easier and easier to do things. You know, email feels passé these days, and it wasn't that long ago since it was quite revolutionary in the workplace. So one of the problems, I think, that comes with impatience, like you say, is a feeling that if I don't succeed at something very quickly, very soon, then I must be shit at it, and therefore I'll do something else instead. It's true. It's a technical term. But I think it's important, like, to think about, okay, so it's not about necessarily seeing them as having a different set of problems, but it's also what wisdom have you got if you've got a different experience, you know, going back to the ball analogy, that you can bring into it. And also, like, reassuring people that, you know, they don't have to be racing ahead at a million miles an hour all the time. I describe myself to people occasionally as a recovering overachiever. On the basis that I was a CEO of a charity by the time I was 28. I had one massive breakdown at 30, which was great. A really, really fun experience I can highly recommend to everybody. But one of the things that I learned from that was a lot of this stuff that we're talking about. There's like this whole, you know, kind of fast-tracked, like we're all fast-tracked into these kind of really exciting and glamorous situations. We're enabled by technology and all this stuff, but you know, there's a whole bunch of learning that just got missed out. And I can certainly remember my school experience, which was obviously just mine, but is not unique, was that it's so focused on learning compartmentalized bits of information, you never really learn how to put it all together, which is something that you kind of have to learn in the workplace. So, you know, good luck with that, employers, because it's a whole set of stuff that you just need to give people the time and patience for. But one of the things that comes out of this a lot, because I see this impatience thing a lot, is that we need to create some safe, it needs to be safe for people to make mistakes. Like, that's the biggest thing that I learned managing my team in sort of, you know, the years before I had my big breakdown and left, was that I needed to actually make it safe for people, but also for myself, which is quite a hard thing to do sometimes, because you're trying to constantly make sure that everything's okay for everybody else. Put your own gas mask on first, was a good piece of advice to have. Anything else that was wildly in addition to? Okay.
Probably just an observation, but I work a lot with graduates lately who've recently come into my council. And one of the things that, and I may be being generalistic and controversial here, but one of the things that I notice being a baby boomer is that I've been indoctrinated into the world of meetings where you have to be there, physically be there, and you have to be there for several hours at a time. And one of the things that happens when you're working with millennials is that they'd rather be anywhere else. And certainly they'd rather be dialing in or Skyping into these meetings. And often there's been a little bit of a, I'm not saying it's socially awkwardness, but sometimes it's their contribution I've noticed at meetings, whereas I'm gabbling on to the nth degree and other people are chipping in who are similar age to me. When you're looking around at the people who are millennials in the room, for example, their contribution is quite weak. They're academically brilliant, I've found, and also the fact that they can feed off scraps, and they're brilliant when they're putting things together and sending you things via email. But the physical meeting atmosphere can sometimes be a little bit awkward for them, and that's probably generalistic, but it's just an observation I've noticed, probably from my coaching environment.
Thank you. So that kind of reluctance to maybe being in meetings and also maybe question of the how people feel about contributing to those meetings and what they've got to give. So let's put contribution. Okay. So not wanting to drag the tone down then. You know, you've got some stuff on here that obviously is challenging, mainly because there's difference. And if we think about going back to making workplaces more inclusive, then and we just have to deal with the fact that people are different and they've got different experiences, and it's not all about eating avocados and not buying houses. then it can be quite interesting to think about how you can start to shape the organisation in this image. So. I found this tool really helpful. Don't worry, there's a slide coming of one that I prepared earlier, but I just think it's more fun to do it on here as well. Okay, so we've got down the side individual and collective, and across the top we've got internal and external. So if we were trying to think about the things that were on the previous sheet, and we were wanting to come up with some names or some group of words that might summarise some of those things. We're going to work through that now. So if something is individual to you and is internal, what word might we use to describe? Ah, belief, a nice one. Let's go with belief for now. What tends to drive your beliefs? Values, yeah? Oh, this is good. I thought this would be easy. I'm sure everyone does a lot of this in their work. Okay, so something that's individual and external. So what do you see? Mm-hmm. Behaviours, yeah. Cool. So collectively, in your organisation, what are the kind of collective values and beliefs? Culture, yeah. Flying through this. Okay, and what would we say then are the collective external? What does that look like on the outside? Reputation. Yeah, reputation. Reputation, meetings. I always kind of summarize it as just the stuff that people can see, that you can see. Now, the thing I find interesting about this, and I'll flick on to the screen up here, just so that people that can't see this will get a neatly drawn, but with one very crucial spelling mistake in it, version on the board. One thing I find really interesting about this is, and I found it super helpful sort of about 3 or 4 years ago when I first saw this, is thinking about how you can work with this. So if we are acknowledging that some of those behaviours that we talked about are kind of up here in the top right, let's have a conversation then about what the values are of the individuals and talk to them about, and let's get to know people a bit better. So asking people what are they proud of, you know, what are you grateful for, what are you hopeful for, what are you looking forward to? All of this stuff kind of pulls out people's values, or veils, as I decided to put up there. I have to point out my own mistakes. So then if we think about the fact that values start to shape your behaviours, that the behaviours of everybody around us, because we're all, you know, constantly trying to work out how to survive in our organisations, those start to feed through into the culture, and they start to change what it's like to work in the organisation. And that eventually feeds through into what you do coming out the other side. So your systems, your processes, your performance, governance, all that kind of stuff, all pops out the other end. Now, what I tend to see a lot of is people go, oh, well, fine, there's a group of people or an individual. What we'll do is we'll work on this stuff first. So we'll bring in a new system. So maybe you've got lots of millennials in your team. We'll bring in a new system, and what we'll do is that will start to change the culture. We'll get rid of the emails, and we'll do X, and we'll do Y, and we'll do Z. We'll do, and that'll change the culture. Now, that might work for a bit, but ultimately it gets weaker and weaker every time you go back, because ultimately there's a really important sense of belief, and what's important to individuals is driving all of that stuff happening. So one of the things I encourage people to do is spend much more time on talking about the values and what's important than let's not worry about the process right now. The processes and systems can be changed later to better reflect the individuals that you've got working in the organisation. Does that make sense? Maybe a different perspective that you've not had before? Maybe not. Maybe it's adding to something you've already got, which is what I was intending to do with this session. Okay, fine. Icebergs. Does everyone know about icebergs? Give us a wave if you've done icebergs before. Okay, so you will absolutely know then, how much of an iceberg can you see above the waterline? Seven? Okay, so I got into a heated debate with some scientists because it's apparently somewhere between 9 and 10%. Depending on the salinity of the water and how far you are from the North Pole. But let's go for 10%. What do we think is the bit you can see if we think back to up here? Yeah, behaviours and our actions. Cool. Just below the waterline, where there's probably like a nice fish swimming around there, what's just lying just below the waterline, do we think? Mm-hmm. Yep. Let's go with... Okay, and then what do we think sits just below all of that stuff? Yeah, what kind of things might be unseen? Yeah, values. Yep. Cool. Some values and beliefs. What do we think maybe at this level might also be in the water? So it's not necessarily internal for the individual. Shark. I can't draw a shark. There you go. Shark, scuba diver. What do we think might be at this sort of level? External. Yeah, we could go with culture. So maybe the experience that people have. I would actually say really kind of your beliefs sit out there, because a lot of the time our beliefs come from the experiences that we have and the feedback loops that we get from the world, right? I'm going to put priorities in there as well. Okay, then as we go really far down, like there's no light down here. There's those weird fish with the eyes on top of their heads and glowing in the dark. What's kind of going on all the way down under here? Say again? Fears, yeah. Yep. Fears, self-esteem. If I were to draw a triangle with five rungs on it, what might be the first thing you think of? Maslow, yeah, absolutely. So Maslow's needs, you've got they're met and unmet. Okay, so underneath all of this stuff, is whether people have got these mise en net and un net. One of the things I find really interesting is in my teams that I've managed, we often had a lot of problems with people because just really basic stuff like short-term housing contracts, for example, mean that you're moving house every 6 months to a year. That makes it really hard to be a fully functioning member of your team if you're moving house every 6 months. It's really, really disruptive. And one of the things that we learned to do really quickly was to talk to people much more about what's going on at home. Should we just stop pretending like work is separate from home? Because it really isn't. And one of the things that I thought was really important is, you know, making sure that we have connections with people. And like we were saying, people want to have a connection with their supervisor. It's not really about being this kind of foreign body to you. They're someone that cares about you and is interested in your life and wants to make sure that you've got all of your needs met so that you can actually function as a person. Okay, so there's a version of that on there as well. I'm sure we can get these slides out to everybody. That'd be easy enough to do. So where am I going with this? Well, one of the things that I just thought would be really interesting to share is just thinking about that group of people with that set of situation and experience and thinking how often do we spend time thinking about whether their needs are met. I mean, not even just that age group, but just also with people that we work with. How often do we spend time thinking about that? For me, it's at the root of quite a lot of stuff that goes on. You know, people can behave really, really crazy at work, but how often could we find out what was really going on if we asked what else does this mean, rather than just assuming that, they're deficient in X, Y, or Z. So it's a really a useful model. I come back to it time and time and time again. Now, there's a really interesting organisation. Has anyone come across the Barrett Value Centre? Oh, hooray, great. So they're based in Bury, north of Manchester. And taking this idea of meeting people's needs one step further, they started to look at how can we think about organisations meeting some of those needs and what happens in organisations where those needs are met. So you've got your classic Maslow here on the left. And what they've done is kind of joined it up to a version that they see happening in organisations. Okay, so if your physiological needs are not being met, people start to prioritise survival stuff in organisations. I've seen this happen a lot, where, this sort of stuff. So if people don't know they're going to get paid, or if people don't know where they're going to be living, or people don't know what's going on, they start thinking about themselves way more and wanting to prioritise making sure that they're okay. And that comes out in all sorts of weird ways, where people might not want to collaborate as openly. They might behave in a way that's really different to how they would normally be. But also, there's some really positive stuff here. Like I always say to organisations that are starting up, like, you need some cash. Come on. As an organisation, you might have all these wonderful ideas up at the top about changing the world, but if you haven't got any cash, you're going to go out of business, and then you're helping nobody very, very quickly. So as you start to move up, you start to see different types of behaviours coming out linked to all of these things. So as people's needs are met and the organisation's needs are met, you can start to do some interesting stuff further up. So relationships are things about the positive stuff is, you know, can I form a good relationship with my colleagues? The negative stuff is let's form tribes and kind of pit each other against each other. Self-esteem is, as an organisation, we're starting to feel really confident about what we're doing. The negative stuff is like becoming a bit arrogant and thinking we're the best at everything and stopping learning. The thing I like about this model is it kind of explodes self-actualization, which is probably the most difficult word I find to say anyway. But it explodes it into these kind of additional levels, because it kind of always felt a bit weird for me anyway, that you'd kind of suddenly have your self-esteem and then you're self-actualizing all over the place. So this idea is broken down into transformation. So transformation is things like coaching, mentoring. It's, you know, continuous learning and development. before you move on into internal cohesion, which for me is all about purpose, like, you know, is there a purpose to you and your life and also in your organisation? For finally moving up into kind of making a difference, so we're thinking about the difference we're making in communities or in our organisation. And finally, the top rung, they reckon, is service, which is where you're thinking about legacy. So you're not thinking about your organisation now, you're thinking about it in 100 years' time and what it could be doing. So maybe thinking about compassion or legacy. Now, there's three I've picked out on here because they're ones I fall back onto all the time when I'm working in organisations, just to kind of have a quick look at, just to see how, when I'm kind of checking in on where things are up, autonomy, mastery and purpose. And these come up a lot in discussions around millennials. If you think back to those original slides, this fits quite well with the kind of attitudes at work. Now, I've kind of summarised some of the stuff that I think fits really nicely here. So purpose, so being part of something bigger, you know, it needs to be meaningful. We can't just be at work being paid to be there. We've got to do something that I give a toss about. To use another technical phrase. Let's have loads of trust. We need to really trust people at work, and that's hard to do because of all the things that we've talked about. So we need to really, really work on that. Some stuff around values and making sure our needs are met. When we go down to autonomy, this is the thing I find really interesting. Lots of people get autonomy confused with silo. And for me, autonomy is about having the absolute freedom to do whatever you want within your playground. And in order to do that, you need really clear objectives and you need loads of permission from everybody around you. And that comes from having a lot of trust. There's some stuff around shared plans, which was a nice one to come up there. It can't live up here. It's got to be down on paper or in some other format that someone can pick up, because then you can be held accountable, and not in a kind of I'm going to pick on you way, but in a kind of we all want to do really good work kind of way. We need clear processes, we need some security, we need to give each other security, make sure that we know it's okay to make mistakes. We need to innovate, and also thinking about like the future responsibility you have for something. So, you know, I always use the example of my dad worked in the car industry for a long time, and they had a big transformation sort of about 15, 20 years ago where he worked in the kind of repairs department, and they suddenly made the repairs department responsible for all of the liabilities that came out of those repairs for up to 10 years on a guarantee. And they kind of wrote that into that department's bottom line, which was really interesting because it starts to make people think differently about how you do a repair if you know that it's going to come back and bite you in 10 years' time if you've not done a good enough job. So that for me is all about autonomy. And mastery is just being really good at something. You know, like if we're all flitting around every 5 minutes, you know, doing stuff, you don't really get a sense of self-worth, and you don't get to build up a sense of what, you know, what it means to do what you do. So I would talk about energy management. We talked about time management earlier. For me, it's energy management. There are the same 24 hours in a day, but I have a different amount of energy at both different times of the day and on different days of the week. So it's learning, mastering how to use your energy in a particular way. It's about creativity. Like how creative is our workplace most of the time? Let's like really think about that. We need way more creativity because, you know, that generation don't get taught it at school. So we need loads of space and loads of freedom to actually explore what that means. And that means like having one good idea for every 100 really terrible ideas, and that everyone's cool with that, and you're not under pressure to be amazing all the time. Some stuff around continuous learning, collaboration, those for me are the things that I've often tried to work with in organisations. So, how does that kind of get used? So, there's some stuff I've been working on for the last few years which I found quite useful. So if we try and put all of that into practice, how can we use the fact that our organisations are changing all the time to kind of get people not learning in a classroom, but actually learning through the work that they're doing? So coming up with a 3-year vision. So spending some time as a group, having got to know each other and what's important to you, coming up with a really clear 3-year vision, doing some closing of your eyes and trusting each other to kind of explore these kind of crazy, wacky, out there ideas, so that you've got a little house on the horizon. And then what you can then do is work out what your 12-month priorities are. So this gives you then permission to drop a bunch of stuff that you've decided is no longer important for this 3-year vision in the future. It helps to kind of create a little bit more security and safety. And then you can break that down into 3-month objectives and some key results. And for me, the difference between, say, key results and, KPIs and objectives and key results is that objectives are all about change. Objectives and key results are all about change, doing something different. For me, KPIs are often about maintenance, and they do have a really useful place. But I've seen a lot of people set KPIs when they're asking somebody to do something quite different. And what it does is it means that we just bullshit our way through to make sure that the numbers stay the same and we stop learning because we're terrified of not achieving. So this one is really interesting. I just picked this one out because it's easy to understand for most people. So an organization wanted to increase their turnover by 50K, specifically their traded turnover by 50K, so that we can show that we've got a scalable model. Now, for me, the most important bit in here is that it's got to kind of be a little bit inspirational. I mean, if you're not inspired by numbers, then, you know, maybe this isn't the right job for that person. But it's got to be a bit inspirational, it's got to be a bit vague, and it's got to be about doing something different. So it gives people space, okay? And the "so that" is the purpose. So that brings out the purpose. If you always put a "so that" into an objective, it helps people to contextualize and understand what they're doing it for. Key results, for me, is the question I always ask people is, what would make it worth doing? So, great. We bring in an extra 50K, and we say to people, okay, we want 7K of that to come from existing customers, because that, to me, would be a sign that we're scaling something that is scalable, as opposed to just bringing in an extra 50K from new people. We could probably launch a big advertising campaign and do that quite easily. Would they stick around for very long? Probably not. This one here was an interesting one. It came out of a conversation where it was that you wanted to make sure that the team felt that they could actually meet the needs of these new customers. So it's like a really long longevity type thing. So 70% of staff report that 6 months later, they're still able to help those customers. It's quite a different space. And you can imagine maybe 50 permutations of what people's working week would look like in order to meet those objectives. The great thing about it is that it frees you from having to do all the thinking. And the other great thing about it is it frees the other person to be super creative. Like, we're all really creative. We just don't really get the space to do it very often. Now, in between your 3 months, you don't just set that and go, right, bye, see you in 3 months. This is where the coaching comes in, and it's great. You're meeting up every 2 weeks, probably every 2 weeks. Be like, hey, that objective, how are you getting on with it? You know, how's it going? How confident are you that you're going to be where you want to be at the end of your 3 months? Do you think you're going to meet your key results? So it's a constant conversation about how are you doing? What help do you need? And can I help you? And you can talk about barriers and all that kind of stuff. It's really, really good. And people, in my experience, enjoy the experience of having one quite simple or straightforward objective, but tons of space in order to achieve it. One thing I wanted to also chuck in, because we were talking about hierarchies. I mean, I'm not really a massive fan of hierarchies, so I constantly seek out different ways of doing things, and I also like to break rules all the time. So this suits me really well. This is a self-organizing team diagram. I made it up. There are lots of really interesting tools and practices around implementing this in your organization, but if we think again about what it is that millennials potentially are looking for, they're not looking for a complex organizational chart. Like, that's just not what they're looking for at work. The thing I love about using a model like this is that when you've got transparent governance and really clear roles, and I'm not saying like, you know, this is your job title and job description, that's you, and then you've got a job description and a job title. I'm talking about what are the functions that each person performs in the organisation, particularly if you're in a small organisation. If you're the chief exec, you'll be washing the pans on Monday morning because no one did them on Friday night. But then you're also going to be doing some strategy stuff, and you're also going to be doing some, you know, speaking at events. And the thing is that if we actually define what the roles are, rather than trying to say, oh, well, we've got an administrator, and therefore the administrator does X, and that's it, you can be much more flexible and creative, if you think about the previous slides, and you can change things as people develop and grow in their roles much more easily. Now, I have a very good friend of mine who is a very accomplished HR lawyer, and we get on really well because he loves this kind of stuff, mainly because HR people freak out quite often when you suggest some of these ideas, and they say, well, yeah, but it will be really unclear, and I can just see all of the lawsuits and the tribunals stacking up against me. No, I think it's about how you do it and making sure that the governance of this process is very clear and that people understand it. Dynamic groups, these should change all the time. You know, so we're working on something for 3 months or a year. Once we've met the objective, once we've discovered something interesting about it, why is that group still together? I mean, maybe we just like hanging out, but we can do that anyway. Like, let's change that up, and then when we've got a new objective, who needs to be in that group? What roles do we need to make it happen? It also makes it much easier for the information to flow around. It's not stuck in a silo somewhere. You're relying on people, because, of course, what I want to point out here is that I could have 1, 2, 3 roles. I could be in all of those circles. They've got to be facilitated as well, which is a really nice opportunity to get people doing coaching and mentoring or facilitating discussion without them feeling like they've got that label on them, which works really well. And also, I talk a lot about tension management. So you get tension between all these things, and there's an element of good tension, and then there'll also be some stuff that will frustrate people and wind people up. And it's actually the resolution of that tension, in my experience, that makes really nice, strong teams, because we get then really comfortable to go, hey, you did that thing, it really upset me, I thought that was my thing, and then we can discuss and resolve what the problem was. So it goes back to, let's talk about the problem rather than you or I. I've used this in a couple of organisations. As I said, there's loads of models and practices, but the organisation I use this most in is an organisation I run in Manchester called the Sunday Boys. It's a male voice choir full of highly academic and articulate people, and this so far has been the only way that it's not been bedlam for the last 3 years, because people are like, yep, I get it, I can do this, this is fine. And also we can talk a lot more openly about what's going on. So again, just a really interesting thing, and it's a million miles away from any kind of, you know, organisational chart that you might have seen before. The last thing I wanted to just share with you, because we were talking about digital, because I've missed out digital and technology the whole way through this, quite deliberately. The last thing I wanted to talk about was an example of some projects that have worked really, really well. I've been working with young people who have got long-term health conditions across Europe. There's about 40 of them every year, and we bring them together to do some kind of leadership development stuff. It's all very lovely. And last year, we did it. Everyone had a great time. And then everyone left. And then we asked them in October, what have you done since? And they went, nothing. Because that's the reality, right? So that's reality anyway. And then if you add on people's medical conditions, like, it just increases the likelihood even further. So this year, what we did is we used a couple of really interesting online platforms. So we start at the top, and we gave them all the input and all the content first. So this group of people were wanting to kind of tackle discrimination. So we did some really cool little online courses that they could interact with, all about discrimination. What is discrimination? What does it look like? All that kind of stuff. So that when we came together to do the face-to-face session in a kind of conference-y feel, people, A, knew each other because they'd been interacting online, which was really cool, but also it meant that we could focus on the soft skills. But what was really interesting about that conference is we'd done so much prep beforehand, we ran out of like sessions to do with them on the conference, and they were actually much further ahead than we anticipated once we were actually on the program. So we had to respond to that quite quickly and make some changes so that people could feel that they were making progress because they were just swallowing up too quickly. We then set them the task of basically doing these reflective journals online. So again, online, brilliant, because it automates all the stuff that's really hard to remember to do, like to send something out at a certain time, which is a chronic waste of human time and attention. Like, we shouldn't be doing that kind of stuff, in my opinion. We've got much more interesting conversations to have with people and ways of interacting with technology than sending things out at a specific time. So let the computers do that. And we set them all these challenges as well. So sometimes it's about like actually having the imagination to get started. So we just set them all these really random and weird challenges, which looked on paper quite random and weird, but were very calculated and deliberate. But it meant that people could just make a start on something, and then they had something to go with. They all went off in weird directions from there, but it was self-directed, and it was about what they were trying to do. And it encouraged them to think really deeply about what they were trying to achieve. And the final bit was then doing some action learning, which, can I say, doing an action learning session across 40 European countries where 38 of the participants have English as their second language was really challenging. Mostly actually trying to get them onto Skype. That was probably the most challenging part of the whole thing. But we got loads out of those sessions, you know, the ability for people to share and ask questions in the way that action learning does. Who's familiar with action learning? Okay, cool, great. So one of the things that was amazing about that is that we've just finished that project in October, and 96% of the participants completed the course and were still active in October, compared to 50% the year before. We've had some really, and so we're really worried as trainers. We came away from Vienna, where the training was, and we were like, oh, well, you know, we should have had more content, we should have worked harder, we should have like thought about it more, oh, they're a bit too prepared, all this kind of stuff. Our results at the end of all of this were way higher than they were before, because actually it's that whole experience. You know, people have actually been able to go out and practice and do something and then talk to other people about how that's gone and get the support. And that's all been facilitated by blending the online stuff with the face-to-face, because online does not replace face-to-face at all. But it can massively increase the experience that people have on a learning program. I mean, it's basically based on the experiential learning cycle. It's not rocket science, but we're just thinking very specifically about what medium do you use for different points in the cycle, and how can you make something much, much longer rather than expecting people to go away and remember anything at the end of a session. If you remember anything at the end of this one, if you remember 5% or 2%, I'll be really amazed. But I'm hoping that this session is just a way of getting you started and thinking about something different to add to the experiences that you've already got. The final thing I just wanted to really leave you with is something I try and live by. It's not easy to do at all, but I work really hard on this all the time, which is a lovely quote by the, I think he's now former CEO of Lego, who's a bit of a hero for me anyway, because he kind of got Lego out of all the oil stuff, which was great. But for me, it's this quote that blame is not for failure. It's for failing to help or ask for help. And that's kind of where I'm at the moment. I spend a lot of time with my teams that I work with saying, come on, let's do a bit more asking for help, and let's do a little bit more helping of each other. And it's a really nice starting point for all of the stuff we've been talking about today. I've done a lot of talking. This is more talking than I would never normally do. There was a lot to get through. Does anyone have any questions or thoughts at this point? Yeah, hi.
I'm just wondering how this fits with Generation Z. I know we haven't talked about that, but I've just been hearing a lot about that lately.
Yeah, I think when you look at Generation Z, I think the biggest difference that you'll see with Generation Z is an increased fear of failure. That's certainly been my experience. I worked for a long time with an organisation where we were training up young people to be consultants, providing their valuable expertise to organisations on what it was like to use their service. And the biggest thing that we had to get over to them was the fact that it doesn't have to go smoothly all the time. There's an interesting thing about technology, which is, from what I've observed, I think millennials and Generation X are probably the worst users of technology. We use it in a kind of really weird, addictive way. Whereas my experience of a lot of Generation Z are spending much more time switching off. They're starting to think about, because it's innate to them. Like, I didn't think about TV as I was growing up because it was always there. It didn't seem weird to me. I remember going on holiday to Berlin in 1993, and I was completely oblivious of the fact that there'd been a wall dividing the city up until 3 or 4 years before. Like, you just don't notice this stuff if you grow up with it. So one thing that I've certainly observed is a kind of polarizing, some people using it way too much and it being a real problem, but also a lot of people developing some really interesting skills around not using their phones and using them in really timely ways to kind of get something done rather than always being on it. Yeah?
No, I'll ask you the question.
Okay.
Someone sitting here thinking a lot of what you've said isn't new.
No.
It's been obviously been around. Mm. So you put, if you read the words of people like Senge, Wheatley, Nevis, other people, it's not new. So the question for me is, does it mean that Generation Y is much more in tune with this idea? And does it mean that the ground is more fertile now than it has been to embrace these ideas?
So the question was, the ideas aren't new, what we've been talking about, but actually, does this mean that Generation Y are just more in tune with this stuff and are basically ready to use it? I would say yes. I think amongst my peers that I spend time with, there's a lot of interest in having a more fulfilled experience at work, and I think this can ride off the back of it. Yeah, does that answer the question, or a bit more?
It definitely does answer the question.
Yeah.
But I'm actually kind of thinking of the question that you mentioned earlier about bringing young people and his experience.
Mm.
And so for me, then the thought is that if you work in a context, a construct of public, local authorities, for example, which is very...
Okay, that's a really good question, and an experience I think that kind of feeds into it is a lot of my friends and people that I've grown up with went into the public sector for a bit. They also did a lot of kind of work with charities and NGOs and social enterprises, and the thing is that they'll move on. And the thing is if they don't have an experience that they relate as being a really positive working experience, they'll probably write off either that sector or that environment completely. There's expressions about what it's like to work for local authority organisations which are not very pleasant. And I think the problem is that there's certain sectors and certain types of organisations now that have just got a reputation for behaving in certain ways. Yes, of course, there's still going to be people that will want to go and it's either not important to them and therefore they'll see through that and go and join those organisations for some other reason. But I'm increasingly seeing people writing off sectors or organisations based on it being too bureaucratic, too top-down, all this kind of stuff. The other thing that we didn't really talk about is the effect of people staying on much later. Like, the wonderful thing about the Equality Act means that you can't get rid of people anymore, which is a really, really positive thing. What it does mean, like a real reality, is that people are staying in their jobs much longer, and therefore the jobs are for development are not coming up as much, which is why I think that something like that is the key thing. Like, if we can just get rid of all of these, you know, kind of structures and have the confidence to get rid of them, you can keep people because people can develop and grow in a way that isn't related to literally climbing a tree. You know, and you can change people's bandings and, you know, pay scales or whatever is important to them, give them more holiday, more time. I mean, I can't tell you the number of jobs that I've been sent by people and said, hey, you'd be really good at this, thanks very much, that's really kind. But I look at it and I'm like, what, 20 days? 20 days and you'll leave a year? No thanks. Like, genuinely, I'd much prefer earning much less money now and working 4 days a week, sometimes 3 days a week. Please don't think I'm lazy because, you know, it really matters to me what I do. But I don't want to be, you know, working until I'm, you know, 65 and then just stop. You know, it's about kind of doing something you enjoy for a much longer period of time. So I think stuff like this is really interesting. Difficult, like, it's not easy, but yeah. No, you're welcome. Any other thoughts, questions, challenges?
It's more of a comment, and it's probably not really that formed, but personally, I'm not sure about having to categorise people by age group at all, because actually I think the whole meaning at work piece is really strong, and I'm sure for all of us, we want to be able to get up knowing we're doing something useful and our purpose is clear. And I think that's much easier when you're not moving houses every 6 months. And I, you know, I get that point. And I look at my son and I think, he's going to be more conventional than me. You know, he went to Silverstone Motorsport College. He's now working for Volkswagen. He's on their career path, going to training. You know, he's got a career. You know, it's more conventional than where I was, dotting around all the time. And he's 22 and he's just bought his first house, got his mortgage with his girlfriend and all the rest. You know, it's quite unusual. I think the bit that came out really strongly for me is about the purpose and meaning and doing stuff that makes a difference and relationship with your manager. And I think that's, you know, people still always leave managers. They always leave managers. They don't leave organisations. So that relationship, I think, has always been really, really key. And the best managers are, you know, authentic and natural and have a relationship. And, yeah, of course it's about the whole person. So to me, you've just undermined what makes organisations get the best out of people completely by the 20 days holiday. I work far, far less now, mostly just mountain bike and ski, to be fair. But I think, yeah, but, you know, when you're at that stage where you're thinking about your future and what you want to do, it has to be stuff that, you know, you make once you get out of bed in the morning, whatever it is. So, yeah, thank you. Really good stuff. Thanks.
Thank you very much. And what I would add on to that then is the title was basically relatively provocative. And the question was, how do you work with millennials? I think you've just answered the question, which is, you know, in a way that is suited to those values. And I think we've probably all acknowledged that a lot of the values in this room are going to predispose people to being more human and more nice people to work with and for. So yeah, if that's what you want to take away from today, then I'd be really pleased with that as well. Cool. Anything else? I wonder if it's maybe time for lunch. Also, in a record-breaking situation for me, we've only finished 5 minutes late. Thank you very much for your time and attention and enthusiasm. I'm going to be around for the rest of the day. If you want to chat to me, do. If you don't want to chat to me, you don't have to. That's great. Cool. Have a nice conference.